Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 35.
35.
It's been a little while since our last podcast episode in early January.
Yes, apologies.
We've been a little busy getting ready for Australia.
Yes, we have. We have done a lot for Adelaide, for Slumber, but what's cool is we're going to continue doing podcasts while we're in Australia.
And there's a whole bunch of Australian circus people who we have lined up, so you'll get a good month or two of Australian interviews, get a sense of what's going.
Well, they might not be Australian, they might just happen in Australia.
Yes, some will happen in Australia and some will happen with Australians in Australia.
So look forward to both.
It'll be some good accents for you guys to listen to.
And we were going to do like an episode right after the news about Ringling deciding to close came out. But then I think we were both so shocked we wanted to digest kind of what was said in the media and the Kenneth and Alana Feld's press interview. So for those of you who don't know, Josh, do you want to explain what happened to Ringling?
Sure. So Ringling announced almost 2 weeks ago now that they will be closing both of their touring units in May. One will have its last performance in Providence, Rhode Island, and one will have its last final, ultimate last time you'll see Ringling on the road in Uniondale, New York, which we got tickets to. So we'll be at the last show.
We were like, we should just get the front row because we always sit in the nosebleeds and just so far back. And I have to squint. And so we're like, we should just do it. It's the last time we might ever get to see this kind of show from Ringling. So let's bring. So they were like $80 each. And now they're like
a few hundred on StubHub.
Dang, we should have sold those puppies. But then we would be scalpers. And then we hate scalpers. Then we'd just be part of the problem.
Yeah, who knows?
But very exciting.
No right thing to do there. No. But
very exciting that we bought our tickets.
Yes, very exciting. And that we're seeing the last show. But I think some people have heard of, you know, what's going on in circus generally with, you know, Big Apple going bankrupt. And I sort of want to highlight the ways in which Ringling's case is a little bit different and sort of talk about some of the things that Lindsay and I found interesting about Kenneth and Alana Feld's press conference. The reason that they have cited Ringling closing is sort of tenfold. There are a lot of different reasons, but number one is that ticket sales have been declining over the last decade steadily, year after year after year. And after they announced that elephants would no longer be part of the shows last year, they saw a much more severe drop in ticket sales. Of course, there's no data to back it up that's available to us because it's a privately held company. So we're sort of taking that on, you know, Kenneth and Alana's word. But I think it's probably true. And aside from that, there are fewer and fewer people coming to see the show. The costs seem to be increasing. If you were to compare it to, say, an arena show that Cirque du Soleil does, and like Toruk that we talked about back in the fall, that show tours with 125 people in buses, while a Ringling show takes over 300 people. They have a whole train. Take it beyond, they have animals. Their expenses are just incredibly, incredibly high and presumably getting higher every year. And Kenneth sort of cited that as one of the big reasons, is an inability to get to bring costs down without really fundamentally changing what Ringling is. And I can only imagine what an incredibly sad decision this must be for that family who have managed Ringling for the last 50 of its 146 years of history. Ringling is older than Coca-Cola, older than American baseball. It's a real institution of our business and of American show business in general. So it's very sad that it won't exist, but I think maybe it was inevitable, particularly the way people were writing about it.
Well, there's like two things that you just said that I think are pertinent. One is the topic of animals in circus as a genre of problems and likes and dislikes. And then also the audiences maybe not needing or wanting or demanding any more traditional American circus as it is known today. And the first is the animals. And I think, you know, people have really different opinions on it. Either you can't...
That's our animal.
Speaking of animals, our cat, he wants to be in the show.
Yeah. See, he wants to be on stage.
You have some people who are like, I can't imagine circus without animals, and they're such a big part of its history and where acts came from. And, you know, our guest today, Otavio, his grandfather, you know, had acts with snakes and chimps and all these different bears, pig. And, you know, you have that side of the board. And then you have the other where it's like, you know, I can't imagine paying someone to do an act with food. Right. And I don't know where I sit. I sit kind of in the middle, I would say. But if, you know, I think like there's a whole talk about PETA and that PETA was kind of like the cause for the downfall of Ringling.
For those who don't know about sort of the PETA Ringling history, PETA spent the last 10 years suing Ringling for animal cruelty, really Feld Entertainment, who owns Ringling, and along with Disney on Ice and Monster Trucks and 26 other shows. They were unsuccessful, PETA. They had to not only pay for however the court case was settled, but also Ringling's legal costs, which was ultimately $25 million out of PETA back towards the Felds. And I think Kenneth said it well, that they won the court battle but lost the case of public opinion.
Yeah. So, which I think is interesting to note that they did win in court, Feld, you know, and PETA lost. But the PETA, I think, ultimately did win. Because the brand and the image of what people would think about Ringling and animal treatment was tarnished.
Yeah. I mean, we couldn't go... Every time I went to go see Ringling, you have to cross a line of PETA protesters. Mm-hmm. Imagine another business trying to try to survive through that.
Yeah. So I think it's a real... I mean, like you said, we don't really know the statistics because or the data because it's a privately held company. But just from reading articles and common sense, it does seem like it really was a... effect if it affected their show. But then that begs the question of like, okay, so if it was the animals that were making people go see the show, then if you take that away, then the show must not be very good if people don't want to see it. You know, it's kind of like a Band-Aid over a cut.
This is true. And one last thing on the animals affecting it. One of the things Kenneth also pointed out in his press conference was that PETA did not necessarily have success in state or federal level courts, but they did have success lobbying towns. So what would happen would be that the show would go from town to town to town to town, and each town would have different permitting restrictions and laws, which made it basically impossible to travel with animals because there's no easy way for them to manage all the various local counties' restrictions on what they could and could not do.
Mm-hmm. But just like everything that's generalized, right? I'm sure that some people did treat their animals badly, but I am sure that the majority of people did not.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's something that was very much generalized. And then this image... I mean, before I was really into the circus 4 years, 5 years ago, I was like, oh, those poor animals. You know, but then once we've been doing the podcast and talking to people who do acts with animals and, you know, I think there's two sides to every story. But going back to what I was saying before, I do think it's like, well, if the animals were the most important, interesting part of the show, and then once they were gone, no one wanted to see the show anymore, or it was even less people, I think it's like, okay, well. Yeah, then maybe the show wasn't very good and no one really wanted to go see it anymore.
Well, I think to do people like Ringling as a show, just with animals or without animals, another interesting thing that sort of came up in this press conference, I don't remember if Alana or Kenneth talked about it, but that basically when Ringling was at its peak, which, you know, is sort of the turn of the century, all entertainment had to appeal to everybody. The circus was the only thing that came into your town. So it had to, by nature, be very, very general and broad in its appeal. It had to work for little kids. It had to work for adults. It had to work for women and men and people with varying different tastes. And since then, basically since the advent of television, things have become tailored towards individuals' tastes and personal silos is one word for it. But, you know, you watch what you like on Netflix, you read the things you like on Facebook, like everything is tailored towards your specific interests. That probably works quite well for new, smaller, contemporary circus companies, but for something like Ringling, which is trying to be very, very, very broad, in its effort to be broad and appeal to loads of people, it essentially appeals to no one.
Now, the problem also with being in an arena versus a tent, because I would argue that like Vasquez and Universal are appealing to the masses.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more niche than Ringling, but still like enjoyed by everyone. But being in a tent is different than an arena. You can really see the people doing it. You can see their faces. You can feel the crowd around you. And being in an arena feels like you're at a movie theater and you can't see the screen because it's three blocks away from you. And so you're like, I'm trying to enjoy this movie, but I can't even see their faces. So, like, I think I know what it's like. I'm not feeling anything.
Yeah.
And I think, like, you know, one of the ideas when we were talking about Big Apple closing was that, oh, maybe they switch to arenas. Maybe that's more the more profitable route, right? And
doesn't seem that way.
It doesn't seem that way, which is also really interesting to note. And I do think circus needs to be enjoyed in the round and close up. And whether it's not in the round, but like in a theater where you can actually experience and feel and see, seems to be like a big component. But then you know.
But they were playing arenas because that's how people wanted to come and see it at the time. Like right. That's what was happening. They were selling those arenas out at one point, you know? And now I don't think they were, in the last couple of years, very rarely selling it out. But I am excited to see the last show because it will be a sold-out arena seeing Ringling. It'll be something very special.
A lot of people strive. That's the other part, right? I said to someone, and I was like, oh, I'm sad because you're like, our kids won't be able to see Ringling. He's like, yeah, but they wouldn't have liked it. I was like, oh, that's probably true. They probably like, okay, mom, dad, like, why are you bringing me to this like old-fashioned circus? Maybe, you know, but who knows? I'm sure I have a feeling that Ringling is going to close this tour, these two touring routes, because it's just too much money, and they'll like figure out another model.
And to make clear, they're not bankrupt. So what is happening is they're just closing it as businesses. The Feld Entertainment owns all of the IP, all of the stuff that you see at the circus. So if they felt like in a couple of years from now they wanted to reboot it in some shape version, one of the things that was thrown at the press conference was a permanent location like in Las Vegas, you know, they still have the ability and right to do that.
But then opposite is Big Apple. What's happening to Big Apple.
Why don't you give a little bit of background about Big Apple?
Well, you can listen to the Paul Binder episode that we did a few months ago and hear about the whole history of how Big Apple was started. But Big Apple is a nonprofit theater. Another difference from Ringling, right? Ringling is for profit. Big Apple, nonprofit. And Big Apple was a tent and toured pretty much the East Coast of America.
Regional versus national.
And right, so that's another difference, right? Just like the geography of where they covered. But Big Apple was bankrupt. Or is in bankruptcy because it just had too much debt to pay off and couldn't make enough money through ticket sales and their corporate buyouts or their fundraising. So they decided to do a big final push to fundraise for it to hope that they could save themselves. And unfortunately, no one came to bat. And so then they had no choice really but to go into declare bankruptcy. So now we're at this point where Big Apple is selling off their assets February 8th, either in little bits or as a full package. And I think it seems like Big Apple wants to sell it off in one big package. So you get the Big Apple name, the IP stuff, the tent. The only thing that isn't included, the two things that aren't included, is the land that they have upstate and the Demarash Park contract, which is a Lincoln Center contract. We know of two entities that are interested in buying Big Apple. One is Bello Knock,
who's talked about it on NBC News or ABC News. Yeah. So I think it's totally a fair game to chat about that. But Bello Knock is a cousin of our guest actually today, Otavio, and comes from a circus family. He was a star of Ringling. He headlined Big Apple and is in the process where he is currently fundraising to buy and reboot Big Apple. So he's one of the contenders.
And the other is an LA-based entertainment company,
which Will Weiss sort of revealed a little bit about during a press release, but is presumably some kind of entertainment based LA company that sees a business opportunity in buying Big Apple. It does not seem like Big Apple would have to be non-for-profit again when they restarted it. They could choose to do it as a for-profit business. But one of the things that you and I have spoken at length about is, would it make sense for Big Apple Circus to go back out on the road essentially the way it was, even without the Lincoln Center contract?
No. No, I mean, it seems like they've almost saturated the market and they need a break. If whoever buys it, you know, it presumably will take them at least a year to rebuild and restructure. So maybe by that time, if coming back to New York and doing the same route would be better, because then they'll have had like 2 years without Big Apple in their town. But I just go back to like, is it in demand? Like, is that type of show in demand? And as much as we can look at the past of traditional circus and you know, admire and learn and be very like grateful for it, you know, things change. And if it's not what like the audience wants, then you can't make the audience want it. You know, it's like, I think musicals are a interesting thing to walk, to look at, because you have like those musicals that were Rodgers and Hammerstein and all these things that were lovely musicals, but they're not what people are dying to go see today.
It's not Hamilton.
It's not Hamilton, but that's okay, because I think Hamilton in that time, people would be like, what is this? But then you can revive it. That's the only thing that I think it might be sad, right? But maybe that's...
Maybe they can revive...
They can revive the Big Apple, like, in 10 years.
Or Ringling. I mean, Ringling seems likely for a single season revival kind of thing. Yeah.
So, you know, I think, like, it's sad, but at the same time, like, industries and companies have to change, and if you don't change, then you close. And I think Ringling did adapt, definitely, but ultimately they were still a traditional circus, just done in an arena.
There's two other things I just want to point out about the Big Apple case that I found interesting, particularly reading Showbiz Dave's blog. You can check that out at showbizdave.blogspot.com. It's the circus blog, and he sort of talks about how he thinks, and I would fully agree with him, that the Lincoln Center location is a red herring. Mm-hmm. That a lot of the people on the board previously on Big Apple, a lot of the buyers, see Lincoln Center as the most valuable part in a way, or a very, very valuable part, mm-hmm. rather than its Achilles heel, which is sort of how I see
it. We said that, you know, like, what, 3 years ago, we're like, stop coming to Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
It's not where you're trying to hit the New York locals, and they are not wanting to go to Lincoln Center.
Well, I don't even know if that means New York locals really even go to Lincoln Center. Like,
that's what I'm saying. They're not going to go to Lincoln Center. Yeah. Go to, you know, like, Brooklyn, Queens. Downtown.
Do what they started out doing, smaller size tent. And that's sort of what his article talks about, is saying, forget Lincoln Center, forget Manhattan. It's not what the circus is about. It doesn't make any sense. It's for people who live locally, who have families and can afford to do it in a more affordable location, close to where these families are. Go back out to Queens, go back out to Brooklyn, which is where the successful shows are playing, like Universal and Hermanos Vasquez.
Yes, they're not in Lincoln Center.
Nope. So my advice to anybody who buys it, Bello, somebody else, do not go back to Lincoln Center. Really think about it. Another interesting point, just hammering why I think Lincoln Center is a bad idea, even Ringling, at the peak of Ringling, would not play New York City as long as Big Apple was trying to play New York City. And when they did play multi-week runs, they would change who was in the cast so that people would come back and see it. I've seen no examples in history of any circus show being able to play the length of run at Lincoln Center that Big Apple was trying to play with success.
Well, I think they did it successfully once or twice with the corporate buyouts and everything, is what it seems like, you know? And I think once they did have a successful run, it was like, oh, we need to have that, because it really probably helped with the finances, you know?
Yeah, but that's 1 year, right? That's the thing we're talking about. You want to do a circus that comes back every single year, then you got to sort of think about your model a little bit. Mm-hmm. But we wish those trying to buy Big Apple good luck on February 8th. If you're interested in buying Big Apple Circus, check out stamplerauctions.com. They have all the information up there. If somebody does not buy the entire lot, I think the minimum bid is $50,000, then they'll start breaking stuff up into little pieces. So if you
have $50,000 lying around to buy Big Apple's IP, go for it.
Yeah, I think realistically it'll land somewhere between $100,000 and $300,000. I think
they
got
it.
I think they would like to get $500,000 for it. Mm. They do these press releases where they say, no, we don't mean $500,000 for it. But I think they're doing it like in a Trumpy kind of way, where they're putting it out there on purpose, even though they're saying they don't want it out there. But realistically, I think if you have $100,000 to $300,000, you know, you could potentially make it yours. Obviously, you would not get the land in upstate New York or the Lincoln Center date, but you'd have the chance to revive one of America's greatest circus institutions.
The Paris Festival just got the awards were given out.
Well, like 24 hours ago, less.
Yeah. And our Korean plank / Chinese pole group that we were going to work with for our show Firefly Field won gold.
Only two people won gold. So big props to Baptiste and his team. They act as awesome. Go Google it.
They're amazing. Super. And they're really nice guys.
Yeah, super nice guys, French and Swiss guys, super talented. The act's got humor, flips, tricks, all these different, and it's really creative. Like, I mean, you'll watch it, you'll see a lot of technique that's original and smart. So big props to those guys. Feeling super awesome for them today, this morning.
Monte Carlo just, whoa, two teeterboard acts won.
Oh, yeah.
Monte Carlo.
Didn't even think about that.
So if you want a medal, a gold, then I guess you need to learn Korean plank and teeterboard.
Yes, you do. And congratulations to the rest of the winners at the festival. Cool thing. Maybe we'll go next year.
My favorite part was the, like, clown guy host.
The guy who's all in
one. And I really like him. Every time he's on, I'm like, oh, I want to see him in person. I wonder if he's as good in person because you're not watching him like on the, he's like talking to the camera, you know?
Yeah. Well, I saw these really good YouTube videos that a circus performer who went to ENC was making where she like took snippets of show A and show B because there are two shows that happen. And if you want to see sort of the highlights and hits of the festival, you can just Google that on YouTube.
Oh, cool. And we leave for Australia next week.
Oh, so much to do.
So crazy.
In the meantime.
So crazy. But very exciting. I'm so excited to see all the other art and circus that's there. It's going to be so different than anything we get to enjoy in New York. So I'm just so pumped.
I'm ready for summer weather. Here it's just so cold and windy and gross. And
yes, I'm very excited for summer. And while we're there, we're also shooting Gravity and Other Myths for our VR video, which will be awesome. They have some ideas about where we're going to shoot. And the location sound mind-boggling because I don't think we have anything like that in America. So they're like talking about it and I was like, this sounds like a magical land,
Australia. Yes, it does.
I don't know if we'll come back. Bye, America. We're going to the land of Oz.
Speaking of VR, both of our guests on today's podcast are also part of our virtual reality circus experience.
Yes, Otavio and Naomi
Gizmundo.
Mr. and Mrs. G.
Mr. and Mrs. G, I met them a couple years ago at the Bach, which is a circus nightclub hybrid in New York City. And they do an amazingly exciting, clever, funny, dangerous crossbow act, which culminates in Otavio shooting an apple off of his wife's head from 35 feet away. All real. I've been there. I've seen it. I've seen the arrow fly through the air. There's no tricks to this. They are just incredibly precise, sharp shooters.
And on the podcast, we talk about Otavio's history and, you know, his life story, but also his book that he wrote with his grandfather. I put in quotations because he edited it after. But his grandfather wrote this book about his time in circus and then his grandfather and his great-grandfather. And it's really incredible, the stories, and I couldn't put it down. So I highly recommend reading it. It's called The Grand Gypsy. But we talk about that. And we talk about how Naomi and Otavio met and how they center themselves for their act. And I don't know, I was sweating the whole time they were talking about their act because I just like, it makes me so nervous thinking that he's shooting a bow and arrow or a crossbow at her head, often with an apple on top of it. My hands were just clammy the whole time.
I feel you. And it's so, I love talking to circus performers, particularly those who are multi-generation. Otavio is sixth generation circus performer. Sixth. Lindsay hates the way I say that number.
You say it like a Brit.
It's always really incredible to get to talk to somebody who has circus so much in their blood and in their family. Really adds an awesome kind of background context to have these kinds of chats.
Mm-hmm. And how Naomi wasn't a circus performer before she met Otavio, didn't know much about it, but then was really into martial arts and dance and just how their skills like totally complement each other. And now they have this act together. It's really cool.
And they performed on Broadway. They have headlined Vegas shows. They've toured all over the world. So really, this will touch on probably anybody's interests.
I think we just skimmed the surface with those two. So I'm pretty sure we're going to have them back on. Maybe one at a time. So we really like delve into each specific
backstory.
Person. Yeah. But if you enjoy the podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, follow us on Instagram for some awesome fun pics that are going to come up because I've been a little bit blasé about it. I haven't posted much, but there's going to be more posted soon. Twitter, tweet us, Facebook us, Facebook like us? Is that what it is now? I don't know. It changes so quickly. I just sound like an old lady complaining about Facebook. And email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. We do get a lot of emails from people, and they're really fun for us to read and to interact with. Enjoy our interview with Ottavio and Naomi.
So where did you guys grow up?
Well, I grew up kind of all over from being from a circus family, but mainly I would say it was Sarasota, Florida, and Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. There was some time in Mexico City as well in transition, and in Reno a little bit later in years, but most of my life has definitely been in Las Vegas.
Is that dictated by your parents doing circus?
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, my whole family, because they had property in Sarasota and also property in Las Vegas. So when I was young, I think Circus opened in 1968, and my family was there performing that, and also my grandfather. And then they had property from years before, long before I was born, in Sarasota, because that was the winter quarters for Ringling Brothers.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. And where are you from now?
I am from Holland, Netherlands. I grew up in the heart of Holland, and in a place called Utrecht. And pretty much there until in my 20s.
Nice. Our guest last week is in university at Utrecht at the moment. Just coincidentally. Were you doing circus-y related things when you were in Holland?
No, no. Just started as a dancer or ballerina, basically. So they put me in ballet class because I was so shy. So that was kind of a way to get me out of my shell, and I think that worked.
I think so. Mission accomplished.
Is your family in the circus at all?
No.
They were like, ballet, go to ballet.
Yeah, go to ballet. Do that.
Did you pursue ballet?
I did, because before that, my dad and my two brothers, we all joined the Kempo school just to learn self-defense. And so we were really busy with that. And then, of course, ballet. So I kind of had to choose, because it got so busy. And I was really infatuated with ballet, basically. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a ballerina. And I did that for a very long time. So helped me along quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How old were you when you stopped doing ballet?
Well, I stopped doing ballet, I guess, not for a long time, because, let's see, I did the dance academy and started to become a teacher as well. So, I mean, I stopped doing ballet, I don't know, 10 years ago? Something classes.
It's so good. Yeah. Ballet was so hard for me to get into, because I don't have a ballerina body, but I loved doing it. I feel like it's such a good thing for the basis of all movement. But it's also just such a hard world to live in. Oh god, I'm sucking in as much as I can. But then it really helps you with your posture and just awareness of your body.
Exactly.
And I know, I'm always like, guys, take ballet classes. And our friend now is taking a ballet class at the Circus Warehouse. Mm-hmm. And he's like, it's helped me with my juggling so much and just body awareness.
Right.
Yeah.
But
ballet tangent. Ativa, did you learn dance or any traditional kinds of things when you were growing up, or were you just sort of handed down circus technique?
It was, it was actually stuff that I had to seek out myself. Because one thing, my mom didn't want me to be a circus performer, because it was a grueling life and something that she really didn't have that much of a choice in. And so she discouraged me learning circus, but of course being around that and all the achievements that my family, had acquired, that's all I wanted to do. I wanted to be in show business. And so growing up, I didn't really have a specific direction. I trained a little bit here and there with my cousins, and then picked up juggling along the way. But it wasn't until I was 19 that I was working as a stagehand, actually, in Hello Hollywood Hello up in Reno, that I discovered dance. And I was juggling, I was training, I was even doing a little flying trapeze. I started that, but was not really very good at it. So I started to focus a little bit more on the juggling, and then the stagehand job came, and I realized that dance was something that I could be interested in. I started going to this one class, and And they say, you know, you're pretty good. You have a natural ability. Because the one trick that I was working on was doing pirouettes, you know, tossing the ball up with a club up and doing a pirouette or two and then turn around and, you know, catch it again and then continue. So I had balanced that, and I was really good with music. I was able to pick out all the different parts of music. And so I was very musical in that sense. So dance kind of just gravitated naturally towards me, and then I gravitated naturally towards dance, I should say, because, you know, the universe revolves around me. Yeah, that's as it always does. Clearly. So after, a year of training or so, a year and a half of training, I landed my first job, which was a chorus line. Not only was I dancing, but I was singing and acting as well in Las Vegas.
Who did you play?
I played Paul. Well, actually, I didn't play Paul. I understudied Paul. Thank God I didn't have to go on for Paul, because I had a difficult trying to connect with that character.
That's a guy that hurts his knee and does the big monologue.
Yes,
and,
exactly. You right. know, I was initially hired as headband boy, who was the understudy. So I had to understudy Don, Larry, Mark, and Paul.
Wow, those are a lot heavy
roles. Yeah, those are a
lot
of roles. Yeah, and then fairly early on into the contract, they put me on as Larry, and then I stayed on as Larry for
Larry
a little
is...
while. He's the assistant.
Right.
Yeah, so, and that was a lot of fun, and it was, you know, great training for me. You know, obviously my first show, professional show,
right.
I should say.
But weren't you like a clown when you were little, like little petite clown?
Yeah, when I say professional, I mean like in theater. that's the course that I eventually moved into. But when I was young, I was around 7 years old, I started working with my godfather at the Circus Hall of Fame when it was in Sarasota, Florida. So, you know, and I'm not quite sure. I didn't really put this in the book, but I'm not sure if that, I think that was my first job. All out job. There was another time that I do remember working in the Robarts Arena, which is in Sarasota as well. And there was a large circus that was there. And I don't know which circus it was. I just think it was like a 1 week thing. And again, I was working with my godfather, and I remember being a baby in this big carriage. And the gag was they had like this tube. They kept feeding me milk. So they kept feeding me milk, feeding me milk. And then they pulled open the carriage, and I come out with this huge belly, you know, as supposed to be as this baby. And I'm not quite sure how old I was, if that was before or after. It potentially is before. I just remember the lights being blinding. I couldn't see where I was going. That was my first experience with a spotlight.
Like, I gotta have it again.
Gotta have it again, yes.
Did you go to regular high school or regular middle school, or were you?
I went to a school in Sarasota mostly. I did go into, I think it was elementary school in Las Vegas and junior high in Las Vegas, because I was always back and forth. And I started to go to high school in Sarasota, but then dropped out and moved up to Reno and started working and got my GED. Actually, I got my GED a little bit later, but I thought that was important to actually have that, because I was in 10th grade and, you know, I had a couple more years to go, and I think, no, I'm going to finish this. So ended up doing that actually when I was performing in the Lido as a dancer.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
How did you guys meet?
Yeah.
We met in Amsterdam doing the musical Aida.
Oh, you were in Aida too.
Yeah, she was a dance captain.
Aida.
Yeah, great show.
So I'm upset. That was like one of the shows that just, if you can't tell, I was a musical theater girl. Mm-hmm. And we had a class at Disney Theatricals. And Bob Crowley, who did sets, came in and talked to him. I was like, your pool moment was like really life-changing. I was like, Josh, did I sound like a real... like crazy girl. He's like, you were like fangirling a little bit. I was like, ooh. But yeah. And then Alan Menken, did he do the music for Aida? Or no, it was Tim Rice
and Elton John.
Yeah. So he played, why did we hear some of the Aida music?
I don't remember.
But again, I was just like fangirling. But
so you met in Holland?
Yeah, we met in Amsterdam. They hired, because it was the first international company of Aida, and Disney Theatricals was partnered with Joop van den Ende to produce that in the Netherlands. And so they hired five Americans from New York. And I remember them calling me up and saying, okay, well, you have a choice. You can do Broadway for about 4 months or so, and then you'll be out of a job when the dance captain comes back, or you can go live in Amsterdam for a year. So I thought, let me think about this. And I was at a bit of a turning point. I didn't really want to leave New York at that time because I was working on these other projects that I was really excited about. But I just thought, well, there's who knows what other opportunities will present itself there. And thank God I did, because this is where I met this beautiful, amazing woman.
A nice souvenir.
Yeah. A partner in life, yes.
Yeah. How did you become involved with AIDA?
I auditioned in Holland for that. So
as a dancer?
As a dancer, yeah. Yeah, and they hired me instantly, so that was really great. Cool. So yeah, so then
were you both single when you met, or was there any like fun?
No, I was seeing somebody.
I was single.
Yeah. But it was very quick because I saw it. So basically how it went, because I was looking at the list of names and I see Octavio, I'm like, oh my god, that's him, because I saw him, like, oh my god, I'm gonna be in so much trouble, right? And so I go up to him, and I speak Italian, so it was perfect. It was, love and love.
First sight. Three weeks later, she was living in the apartment that they had provided for us, and then we lived together for an entire year there in Amsterdam. It was an amazing experience, the show and getting to know each other and everything that we had in common. It was great, yeah.
How quickly did you guys start working on duo acts together?
It took a little bit. I mean, while in Holland, I was contacted by, he was the company manager for Saturday Night Fever. How I got to New York, I was living in Las Vegas, and Arlene Phillips, who directed Saturday Night Fever in London, they were opening the Broadway production. And she had seen me, I mean, she worked with me in EFX, and I was principal understudy in EFX. And,
another one of my all-time fave shows.
That was a fun show, yeah. We worked together in when David Cassidy was brought in, and she came in and started directing the show. I actually worked with Michael Crawford as well. He was directing me in how to say this one line that the Master of Time had. And I remember going over it and over and over it with him. And then he had an injury, and then all of a sudden he was out. And then they had to put all the understudies on. So I went into the show early, actually, as the Master of Time in this principal role. So I had done that for like 3 months, and then they finally got David Cassidy, and they figured that all out, and then they brought Arlene Phillips in.
What was the one line?
Oh, it's about dreams. No, it's about dreams. It's about dreams. No, it's about dreams. Emphasis on dreams. I'm like, okay, I think I got it. Yeah. So that has been burned into my brain. But then Arlene Phillips came in, and she knew me from that. And then when they came to Las Vegas to do these auditions, showed up and got the job with a few others from Las Vegas, and then we were there doing Saturday Night Fever. So this is a long explanation to get back around to our duo acts. We actually started working together, choreographing and doing stunts, because while I was in Holland, back to that, I was contacted by the general manager who was running Saturday Night Fever to create the stunts for Spider-Man Live.
So you did Saturday Night Fever on Broadway?
Yes.
And then left that to go do AIDA?
Actually, no, that closed.
Oh, it closed.
Yeah, that closed on Broadway, because it was on Broadway for about a year and a half. All told, the whole experience was about 2 years, I guess, or so. And they were choosing the people that wanted, asking people who wanted to go on the tour. And at that point in my life, I wanted to stay in New York because, like I said, I was working on these projects. I had this stunt musical idea that I was pitching to them and to some other producers. And funny enough, it was called Virtuality.
Nice.
Dealing with virtuality in life.
You were ahead of the times.
Yeah.
All that.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. And so, funny. And so, because of that, and that experience, that's because Jeff Scherzon contacted me, because he knew that I was involved in stunts and circus history, or in circus and all those elements. So while in Holland, I was writing stunt scenes for this show that they had negotiated with Marvel. So it was a joint venture between Marvel and their company. And then her father actually became my sensei. So I started training in Shorinji Kenpo martial arts, and I used that knowledge to create these fight sequences that we worked on together.
For Spider-Man
Live, yeah.
So Spider-Man Live, not meaning Spider-Man the musical.
Correct. This was 2000.
Ill-fated Spider-Man. Yeah. The musical.
We're talking 2002, right?
2002, yeah.
2001.
Yeah. So we came back. Mm-hmm. The reason why I left AIDA was because of Spider-Man Live, actually. Otherwise, I would have signed another contract and would have stayed there performing the show because super happy and it was great. And, you know, we had a great life there. But that was an opportunity I couldn't pass up because, you know, it was going to play Radio City Music Hall and the Wang Theater in Boston.
Oh, I love the Wang.
Yeah, all these amazing really theaters. Nice. And it was supposed to be a world tour and all of that. So we did that for about a year and sold out Radio City Music Hall, which was really super exciting. And she actually had her American debut
there.
At Radio City.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. What a theater.
I know. It was pretty awesome.
So you guys were in the show as well as choreographing the fight scenes.
Yes. Yeah. I did the, I was the Green Goblin. We had a flying apparatus. So I was doing the flying part of
it. Did
the
you
Green
see
Goblin
Spider-Man the musical?
No, I never
you
did.
You didn't.
I know. I never did.
Because when I was reading your book, I got confused. I was like, is this the same thing as Spider-Man the musical? And I was like, if it is, I saw the Green Goblin get stuck over my head for like 10 minutes while they had to like restart the whole apparatus. I was like, I wonder if that's Octavio. But Octavio. Octavio. I just say it every way I can. So you played the Green Goblin. I'll get him. The Green Goblin. Who did you play?
I was swinging the show.
Oh,
so,
cool.
Yeah.
That's... And then, so you got to do another show together.
Yes.
So the romance continued.
Yeah, that's lucky. That doesn't really always happen before people are doing, like, duo acts together where you can get booked on the same shows consecutively.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And shortly after that, we moved to Las Vegas. I had a house there, and then we moved back, and it was, you know, I had done another show, in dance show in Vegas. And there was a couple times that we got to work together in another show where we were partnering each other. But then we started developing the crossbow act because my sister and her brother and her husband, my brother-in-law, Ross, they were they had been performing a crossbow act for a number of years, you know, Guinness Book World Records, and, you know, traveled all around the world and done the, did that for a while. And they were turning down work that they couldn't get. So they asked us, and said, well, would you guys be interested in learning the act? And she was all about it.
I'm like, yeah, let's go for it. Because then we can, like, incorporate all the other things, like martial arts and dance, and then, you know, give it our own spin. I think it sounded great to me. So we did.
Yeah, so we did. So we went up and we trained and took the equipment back down to where we were here in Vegas or there in Vegas. And we trained for a whole year and just started piecing together how we would present our act. So, and now we have so many versions of it. We're always evolving, trying to work in a new space. We used to think it was pretty... that we were limited to, that we could never perform our act on a small stage because just the nature of it. Mm-hmm. And to our surprise, it actually works on a small stage as well.
Yeah. I think the video I saw is it's like a round small stage and you guys are moving around. It's like
a
heart.
Spiegel tent?
Yeah. But it was someone I don't know. I think you posted it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, how does it work? And Josh always says, I've seen it up close and personal. It's real. It's not a magic trick.
I've seen it fly. I've seen backstage. Like, there's nothing to it. But what's the training process like without giving away the secrets of it too much? But what is it like to go from, I mean, did you guys shoot guns before? Like, did you have any kind of experience of this kind of thing?
No experience whatsoever for me. So it was completely new. And it was hard. It was hard to... Because it is scary. It's still, you know, it's dangerous, of course. But it was, start shooting.
Yeah.
Target practice, basically.
Yeah.
Do you use the same level of, like, crossbow when you start as what you guys use now?
Yeah. The same crossbows that were initially given to us by my sister and brother-in-law. We still use them to this day. We've purchased other crossbows and, you know, trying to broaden our horizon so that I can, in the event that anything does happen to that with parts or whatnot, that we can go to another set. But it's just like an old shoe, you know, it just feels so good.
Yeah,
I can take it off and, you know, be accurate with it. Whereas the other one, it's a bit of a learning curve because it's just comfortable. But I mean, we get there eventually. It just feels odd.
So there are a few moments in your act that I just love, but one of them is when you like click the rope back or whatever the line is. So is that particularly like extra loud and done like because for like stage effect, or is that like part of the normal crossbow like setting it up kind of thing?
It's just the normal setting up.
So it's just genuinely that scary without
there's a good click. Yeah. I mean, you want to definitely hear that click because that with this particular crossbow, that means also that the safety is engaged right away too on top of it. So some crossbows don't engage the safety right away. So you have to put that in and then take it off. So that's one of the great things about this brand of crossbows. My brother-in-law had me, one of the first things that he had me do was take it apart. Take it completely apart and reassemble it back. Mm. And that's come in very handy when trigger springs break, which they do inevitably. And I was able to get new springs, so I'm pretty good. I was like, oh, another one broke, so here we are. And I was like, at least it's not, you know, a half hour. I've had that happen during a performance, too, where all of a sudden I pick up my crossbow and I go to cock it, and it won't engage. It won't stay cocked. So I look and I realize, oh, okay, I guess we're working with one crossbow today.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Do you want to explain your most basic act for people who haven't seen it?
The most basic one, the one that we usually perform, involves us appearing with our crossbows. Sometimes we'll integrate a little bit of dance, sometimes a little bit of martial arts, but generally we will pace off and we'll turn around and we'll fire at each other as like a duel to set the tone for the act. And then from there it'll escalate. So we try to tell a bit of a story also within the context of the dance and the shooting. So I produce flags that I start doing. So white flags, so it's like I'm surrendering, or I'll pull a heart from her corset, her chest, like I'm stealing her heart, and then she'll, you know, then I'll shoot it out of her hand. She'll shoot the surrender scarves out of my hand, and then we just kind of escalate, and she takes a playing card, ending with the apple. So that's the, you know, the iconic image of, you know, shooting an apple off her head. But we don't do the ricochet effect. I mean, there's not that many crossbow acts in the world, but there are a number of them, and there, you know, more and more are coming. Just that's how it is. And but what we've chosen to do is not to incorporate the whole ricochet because it takes so long to set up.
What's the ricochet?
Basically, it's having crossbows on a stand.
Oh.
So when you have them on a stand, then you can, you know, have one crossbow aimed at the other crossbow and so forth. And so it just, you shoot at the one crossbow and it creates this chain effect of across the stage, ending with the last crossbow shooting an apple off the top of your head.
Oh, like.
Yeah, exactly. And so my sister and brother-in-law, they hold the Guinness Book World Records for having the most crossbows firing across the stage. And what's unique about their act is that they have a double one that shoots and hits apples on both their heads on opposite sides of the stage.
Dang.
Yeah, which is cool. Now, we've chosen not to go that route because how we present our act, it's in the context. We try to keep it moving in the context of a story.
Well, so I thought like the two things I think are so awesome, aside from the technique and the danger and skill involved, as I say, is that there's always a story between you two in all the versions I've seen. I think I've probably seen maybe three different versions of the number.
Right.
And there's always like a clear dynamic that's going on and shifts where it's like playful at times.
Right.
But also like the musicality. There are very few numbers that I've seen that also because you're literally pulling the trigger on whatever part of the song it is, where like you're working with that build, and then right as like the song drops or the moment happens, you guys like release and the trick happens.
Right.
Yeah. And it's just an insane combination of stimuli for the audience to experience.
So what are you thinking when he's about to shoot an apple off your head? Like, stay still. Like, don't move.
I hope I'm not moving.
And sometimes the apples are odd shaped.
Yeah.
So she's requires a little touch and go, making sure that the apple is there. And I can see her, like, she brings her hands up. And I'm like, okay. And then I just wait for her to move her hands. And obviously, sometimes we try to do it on the music. A lot of the shots, like you said, you know, and that presents challenges unto itself. But what we've been experimenting with lately, not so much in the nightclub version, like we're performing at the box, say, we just keep the music rolling for that. And that is on a, you know, nice ending note. But for circuses and other venues, what we've had them do is bring the music down into complete silence. And that has been a great piece of advice that we were given, too. You know,
it really adds to it
in a dramatic moment. So somebody gave us that, Steve Bohr, actually, for when we were performing in Macau. So why don't you just try, you know, just getting the music out.
Yeah.
See,
also, because there's a big thump when it hits the the wall or the pad or whatever.
The target behind it. And you hear the release of the bow. So you have that really snap click.
Sound,
and then all of a sudden it's like, you know, boom, boom, you have that two effect. And so, and he came back to Macau and he goes, you know, I love it when I give somebody a piece of advice and then they build on it. So what I did was, you know, we had the music come down, I leveled towards the apple, and then I release for a second and I give myself a nice little breath.
You give yourself a breath. And people's like, no!
Yeah, that's an opportunity sometimes for people to chime in.
Right.
And be like, or they get a breath, too.
That's like that fake jump rope trip on Wheel of Death.
Yes.
You're like,
They catch their foot. Yeah, it's that same kind of moment, you know, to create that build and then, you know, come back and level and take the shot.
And you guys do a very specific kind of like yoga sort of centering process before you guys do your number, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk about how you, because it's original, you created it, from my understanding. Can you talk about how you guys created it and what it does to help in general?
Well, it definitely helps yoga in general, I think. Helps to calm down, helps to calm everything. So we just started, okay, so how we got to the yoga. So somebody, a friend of ours, says like, okay, come take a yoga class in Vegas. And so we dabbled here in New York a little bit and in the various styles. So when we got to Vegas, we went to It's Yoga. And that was it for us. It was Ashtanga based, and they happened to have a yoga
teacher training.
Like, I got to do this, you know, just something for myself and something different. And we ended up doing it together.
Yeah,
correct.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so from after that training, we decided just to incorporate the martial arts because that always has helped us in finding strength and calmness, I guess, as well. So we just decided to incorporate the style that my dad used to teach with the yoga, and that's how it kind of came about, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
So we use that to center ourselves. So one of the things that we always do is, you know, we check ourselves for one before going on to our performance, make sure that we're centered and focused and calm. And then have to check the equipment because it's something that you can never be lax on. And that goes with, I think, all forms of when you're dealing with dangerous acts, you know, especially with aerialists too, you know, making sure that the equipment is sound. So I always check, you know, the bolts, make sure that the bow is not askew or is not the sight isn't off. That's one thing that we learn, you know, while traveling, because we travel so much that I've learned over the years that, oh, I have to protect the sight. So because the sight sometimes gets bent if something hits it, and then you're looking in the wrong area, and then the bolt is going to fly in the wrong area, and that's not a good thing. So so we always do that and just make sure. So that's been our process. Always fire, test fire, and make sure it's good, and we try to practice as well, depending on the distances.
Right.
That's always a challenge, too, because every stage is different. You know, generally we like to shoot within 35 feet. That's a nice, you know, nice distance for us to shoot. But as we're here at the box, you know, we're talking maybe 10 feet or so. So
is it
that changes the evolution.
Slower, or does it change the speed or the drop or any of these kinds of things, the distance at which you guys are shooting from one another?
It can. Yes, it does. I mean, we're dialed in for a specific range, and that's what we're comfortable with, and it looks nice when it's a little bit further up close. It, like I said before, it does work, but that does change our.
And you do have to adjust.
You have to adjust. Yeah.
Yeah. As in with any venue, right? It's just different.
Yeah. Does air conditioning and things like that affect you guys?
Not too bad. I mean, if it's like really crazy winds, that could affect us when we're performing outside.
Yeah.
But for the most part,
And anything can happen, right? Yeah. Sometimes we've had performances that all of a sudden it's It's black.
The lights will black out. All of a sudden, power outage. You know, like
there's a lot of wind.
Yeah, there's too much light sometimes. Yeah, you know, if you have a light that's shining in your eyes, yeah. And we can, you know, we work with the designers to have that adjusted.
Yeah, but we're pretty flexible.
Yeah. That's one thing that we've learned in these travels is to become flexible on these different stages and just to always respect what we do and never to take anything for granted.
Speaking of traveling, how do you guys travel with that stuff? And like, there must be everywhere, you're talking about going to Indonesia earlier, but like, there must be places who are like, what the hell are you bringing on the plane? Or what is that?
I didn't even think about that.
Oh yeah, Dubai was, they had a special license, I guess it was, from the Ministry of Defense. I mean, it was like high up. the special thing. So we had police escort in and out of the airport in Dubai.
Whoa.
Yeah. While we were in Macau, that was funny. That was interesting. Though we also had a special license there. And when we got there, usually the boats fly with us as luggage. That's one of the great things that we've discovered also with our act, that we didn't have to have so many things. You know, we can travel with 5 bags, 4 bags sometimes. It just depends. And so...
that's a skill in itself.
That's a skill in itself, the packing and all of that. Yeah, exactly, to say within that. But for China, for Macau specifically, the crossbows had to be imported. They had to be shipped separately. So they did that. And when we got there, the police examined everything, immigration examined everything, and then also there was hotel security. So it was a 7-step process in Macau every time for us to get the bows just to practice. So it was crazy. So the first step was the head of security and a security guard and stage management. We would all meet upstairs, and they would call to the camera room to make sure that they were watching. So... that was step one. Then the stage manager would swipe the box. Then the head of security would swipe the box, and the box would open, unlock, and there's the key hanging inside, locked. So stage manager would swipe, head of security would swipe, the key would be released so that they can unlock the door, step six, to then get the crossbows that are locked inside a box, step seven.
So dang.
Every day. It was like amount of security.
Wow.
And then there was also police that was watching the show. And we had our personal security guard that would always guard the crossbows when we were not there. Because we would practice before the show, and then we put the crossbows away, and the security guard would stay and monitor the crossbows while we were getting ready, and then we come back down, and then we do our performance and so forth. So sometimes there's really extreme measures for safety, which we're okay with, you know, obviously. Yeah. If that's what they're comfortable with, then that's what that needs to be done, you know. So,
whereas in New York, you're like, got it in my purse. Here I am.
Walking through the crowd. Here we go. I was like, oh, my God, that's a crossbow. You're like, yep, it's about to happen. That's right.
Like if I saw you guys in Times Square, I'd be like, whoa.
Do you have like a favorite trick in that number that you guys like doing the most? Or is it all... fairly similar as far as how it feels when you're doing it.
There's some really fun moments. What's your favorite shot?
Oh, my favorite shot? That's hard.
It is.
I do like the card. I do like the
card's
card.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, the card is really good. Because all of a sudden it comes
awesome.
Down to that small.
Yeah. And your fingers are like right there.
Yeah, the playing card, right? Exactly. Yeah. Shooting the playing card out of my hand.
And the apple is fun.
I like the heart.
Oh, the heart.
That's
card.
This is a new thing that I don't think you...
I saw it on the video.
Yeah. And that was particularly exciting in the Spiegel tent because there's audience behind us as well.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
my God.
I put the
I'm
heart
just
on my
sweating.
Chest.
This whole time you've been talking about your act, I literally am sweating and my hands are clammy. I'm like just nervous.
Yeah. The interesting thing about that is because I'm putting the target on my chest and I'm letting go. There's no real room for error missing up, down, left, right, or anything like that because that's going to hit me, obviously. So... shoot for that, whereas the other ones you're a little up, a little out.
Have I seen you do a trick where you like have it and you sort of catch it on your hand as well?
Yeah, reach out and catch it.
Yeah, I've seen that once, and that to me stuck out to me as like, oh my God, because it sort of feels like you have to catch it as it's moving past. Although I'm sure you guys have, done it a million times. It's like,
we can get our timing down, but still, it's really quick. And again, you're looking at distance. If she's closer, that's a lot faster. So
right.
But you're fast.
But I'm fast.
So what was your first job? So you learned this act from your sister and brother. Are they still doing the act?
Yeah, they do it occasionally. Yeah, they still.
So you learned the act. And then what was your first gig or show that you were in doing it?
Oh, it was, we showcased it in Laughlin for one weekend. That was just to kind of get it on its feet and mm-hmm. work it out. And
were you so nervous the first time? Or
Yeah. It was completely different from anything that we're doing now. Because we had this whole bit of...
this whole story to attach to it, yeah. Like, of course, being, you know, the director, choreographer, that we, like, you know, that
oh,
we are.
We need to make it bigger.
Let's make this whole story out right, of it, right. You know? And, it was a lot more than it actually needed to be. And I had a projection, like it was projecting onto a TV. And I was watching sports as well, you know, and so she was disgruntled and coming out. And then I changed the channel to a Dr. Phil show.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I want to see your woman out of control. Does she need to be put into her place? And then, you know, she's coming out with the crossbow, slowly cocking it, you know, and shoots it over my head into this TV. And then that kind of sets the tone for the act.
What a cool opening idea.
Yeah, that actually is really awesome.
Yeah. It was very elaborate.
It was a little too elaborate for the first time. Right? Yeah. And then we figured out ways to scale it down and, like, to still project some of that through dance and symbolism, you know, like with the flags and the heart and all that stuff within the context of a song, as opposed to having all these other props in. Mm-hmm. And obviously for travel.
Right.
The first time that we did our Doors version, if you will.
The band The Doors.
Yeah, that's the remix of Break On Through, which is such a great song, was here at the Box. And we were doing this tour with Dos Equis, the most interesting show in the world that they had hired us for. And on that tour, we performed on the largest stage, and that same night later, it was the smallest stage we ever performed on. It was Webster Hall, and then later that night, we came to the Box, and it was like,
oh yeah, wow. Two extremes,
yeah, and it was a lot of fun. And then that was the first time that we performed that number, and it just kind of stuck. And I was like, okay, I think this is what we're working with now.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we changed music and we're different to accommodate different places, but yeah, it's been fun.
So more recently, you've published a book that you co-wrote, I guess is probably the right way to say it, or you wrote large portions of along with your grandfather.
Co-wrote, like, what, 30 years apart?
Yeah, right. Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, my grandfather wrote his memoirs. It started in 1970 after he finished performing. And so he had this book that he spent about 5 years writing, typing out of his life, remarkable travels that he had. And it sat in our family archives, if you will, for years, just kind of as an unfulfilled ambition for him. I think he did try to get it published at some point, but it just never happened for whatever reason. It did require editing. And that's when I took the project on.
Which is how long ago?
This was actually when I was doing Saturday Night Fever here in New York. So 1999.
Oh, wow. So you've been working on it for a while.
For a while, yeah. I would pick it up and then I would... The first step was taking this massive book that he had, single pages typed, and then his photographs glued to some pages as well. So there's all these photographs. So I had to transpose that over into the computer. So that took a while. And that was the first step. And then, of course, at the same time, I'm working on all these other ideas.
Wait, so he hand wrote all his...
No. It was he was typed.
Oh, it was. It was typed, but then you had to.
Yeah, transfer it into a Word document.
Right.
You know, that was the first step. And then I'm like, as I had mentioned before, working on all these other ideas for shows. And then Spider-Man came along, and then moved to Holland, and so it's like all these things. So off and on, it had been a number of years, you know, close to 15. Finally, when we would sit down in these places, through Naomi's encouragement, she would say, you know what, maybe this is time, maybe you have the time now to actually finish that and make that a reality. And I think that's a great idea. So I started the process, picked it up again while we were performing in Spain, because we were sitting there for a good while. Mm-hmm. And then I continued the process while we still traveled a little bit, and then finished it while we were in Macau, China.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then came back and published it, and it was published on his birthday. Technically, it might have been the day before, as Lulu says in the publishing, but it actually was released and for sale on his birthday.
That's super cool.
Yeah, and that's what I kind of planned for.
What was it like learning that amount of history? Because you must have known growing up, like, oh, I'm from sixth generation Stormstormer, and I would be must have heard these stories, but was going through this in an additional level of detail sort of enlightening, or did you learn a lot about your family that you didn't know?
Yeah, absolutely. There was more that I had to learn, too, because there were gaps within the story. One thing about the book, which was great, I mean, you had all these photographs, and then you had the stories. Or maybe the other way around, you had these photographs to back up the story, you know, going to see the Sphinx in Egypt when only the head was sticking out, you know, on tour in Egypt. And then he comes back a year later and they're excavating the body and he has a photograph of that. So it's, you know, that's some remarkable stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was really exciting rediscovering that. And then talking with my two aunts, Aunt Aurelia, Nock, who is Bella's mother, and Michelangelo, John, and Oigi. And then my Aunt Chichi, who Celeste Ataide, and she was my mother's sister. She was the youngest of all the siblings of my grandfather's children and grandmother's child. And so it was great, you know, speaking with them and, you know, just filling in the blanks, basically. And then all the research that I had done online, I had to redo again because it was a process, you know, and I was trying to figure out how am I going to present this book because it's his book. It really is his book. And I co-authored it in a way, but I just wanted to make sure that I filled in what was supportive and necessary to fill it out, basically. And there are a lot of interesting things that are different now to when he traveled to these exotic lands. Like when he was in India, he went to go visit the Parsis Tower of Silence, which was a big thing. It was just covered in vultures and crows because they would come and feast upon the remains of the dead. But there was, you know, at some point the vultures were, the population was disseminated because of disease and they couldn't understand why. So in recent years, you know, I had to revisit that. I had one explanation. There was no explanation because they hadn't figured it out yet while I was first putting the book together. And then just a few years ago, I was like, oh, they did discover why that was. So it was an interesting process having to fill it out and put it all together, but in support of what his story was.
Would you give a short version of like what your grandfather performed and just like a little bit of a teaser of what sort of his life story is?
Absolutely. Like? Yeah. Well, he was born in 1896 in the back lot of his father's circus. In a caravan, basically, that his father had built. And he toured the world. He performed in the Krona Circus, toured Italy and Germany from 1922 to 1924. And now this is the same time frame that Hitler was delivering his speeches at the Krona Circus in Munich, Germany. He then, after that, traveled through South America and then went to the Middle East. He performed in Mesopotamia when it was Mesopotamia, in Baghdad and Mosul and Basra, then traveled through India. He witnessed Mahatma Gandhi deliver a speech in 1931 after he was released from jail. And then he traveled through the South Pacific. He went to these remote regions of Borneo and Sumatra. And things that we take for granted now, like we just performed in Indonesia, right? It was like, oh my God, this long flight and we have to get there. And can you imagine what it was like to travel and to transport a circus?
Well, there's that story about the boat trip.
Yeah.
The animals having the separate one they get stuck in the storm. I was just thinking about it, like, oh man, so crazy. It's the most dangerous part of this guy's life who involves doing these crazy animal acts and crazy circus acts is just getting from one continent to another. It's like where his life is in the most dangerous.
Yeah, because everything was by steamship or train there. I mean, planes were, you know, a rare commodity for the elite.
Yeah.
And it was definitely not a viable thing to transport for them back then. So it was either by boat or train. When they were in Egypt or traveling through the desert, they used Model T Fords to travel through the desert to get to their other destination. The whole circus company by camel caravan and Model T Fords.
Well, I thought what stuck out to me was when he writes, like, you know, the ultimate dream was being in Ringling and that was like the best circus, the biggest circus, you know?
Yeah.
I was like, it made me so sad.
Right.
It's like, oh God, like, you know, it's these generations of circus performers who was like, that was like, that was it.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's yeah, it was no the longer pinnacle, right?
It was the pinnacle. I mean, because he came and performed his in 1932. The family was discovered by John Ringling in Europe. They were performing with, I think, the Klutsky Circus in Czechoslovakia. Hmm. And he was they were there doing the unsupported ladder act. And then they were brought over to come and do that. And on his opening day at Madison Square Garden in 1932, he was attacked by his 25-foot python.
That is a crazy story.
That he brought
story.
Over with him.
That he brought over with him. Yeah, that wasn't allowed on board, right. But he fit it into a suitcase somehow. And then they discovered it was on board, and he was worried that they were going to throw the animal overboard. But then all of a sudden he was accepted, and the captain asked if they would do a performance in the theater. So they did, and all of a sudden it was well accepted. And when they arrived, all these newspapers showed up to take pictures of it. The interesting thing, too, is that, you know, when that happened, when the snake grabbed a hold of him and sunk his fangs into his shoulder, all the people that came to assist, and we're talking about circus legends as well.
Yeah, Alfredo Cadona was in the story.
Yeah, Alfredo Cadona came and assisted that. And so this was a year, I think a year or two before he finished flying with Ringling Brothers. And this was a year after Lietzel had passed away.
Mm.
Yeah, so it was just right in
it's
that
a really
transition.
Amazing moment of Ringling, too, because it's really prior to things getting tough the first time around
right.
for them with World War II is really when historically they started having economic challenges. So it was really still at that peak of...
Yeah.
Peak of fame.
Oh, yeah.
Man, we're talking about the book for forever, really. But one of the things, since we're now getting on to Ringling a little bit and the book touches on, and I've never read anywhere else, is a story that starts almost prior to tents being a thing.
Right.
Like your family in the circus, your family's circus history and in the book starts off with basically touring in town squares and public spaces. And coincidentally now, as tents are struggling to figure out their place in America... It was, as I was reading it, I was like, oh, wow, you know, one thinks this has been a thing that has always been there. But just in this, you know, your 200-page, 250-page book, you get the history of prior to that almost all the way to what is maybe now after that or the other end.
Right.
But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, like, what it's like seeing all this change, not only in, like, your personal family history and reading the book and what is happening now, but... I don't know. It just really struck me as an amazing thing as I was reading it.
Yeah, it is sad to see the decline happening now with the circus, but it's been happening for a number of years. Unfortunately, it's not. It doesn't have the same thing here in the U.S. as it does mm-hmm. in Europe. You know, Europe circus is more revered. You know, there's a lot of money pumped into it as well. And you have a lot more circuses and a lot more venues and the tent thing. So yeah, in the book, which is interesting because circuses, when they became popular again, started to become popular again in the 1700s. And then obviously it started to grow from there in the 1800s too. There were the permanent amphitheaters, right? They would build these circus theaters essentially, but there were too few of them you couldn't have them in all the remote regions. So that's when they would go and perform in open squares because they didn't really have the luxury of a tent. It was just easy. Everybody has their caravan. They, with the horses, horse-drawn caravan or other animals, get to the destination and then set up a show. And it was based on, you know, passing the hat. So it was almost like busking, mm-hmm. but it was an entire show based on just donations. So part of the story in the book is that it happened in Budapest that my great, great, great grandfather put on a show in Budapest in one of the open squares in Pest. And that's when they would try to entertain the masses. And then after that, shortly after that, then it would be when tents started to become popular here in the U.S., then they started to build their homemade big top. And they built it and they put it up, but then
that's
they realized after it rained, it would still leak onto the audience.
Right.
So they had to waterproof the tent. So they would get fat horse fat from the butcher and mix it with kerosene.
Very flammable waterproof.
I know. I was like, yes, oh, that
exactly.
is flammable fat. Just covered in kerosene. I thought the next part was like, and then it went into a big flame.
Right.
So was that your grandfather's father grandfather
yes.
that did the tent
yes Eduardo Fumagalli did the tent, so that would be my grandfather's great-grandfather.
The other part of the book that is so amazing to me is how many well-known circus families that are connected to your family and also just the shows that your family has worked on. Like,
yeah.
You have Fumagalli. There's like the Willenda such a story. The Cadona such a story.
Knee is in there too.
Vasquez.
Vasquez
is like the Knox.
One
thing about that. Actually, even this morning, my cousin Michelangelo Knox, he has this treasure of photographs that he's been unearthing. And today he posted on Facebook a picture of my grandfather and who I believe is either my Uncle Freddie or it could be my Uncle Rido in Egypt in 1926 in front of this open-aired mosque.
Huh.
Which we haven't seen before. You know, my aunt right. even was like, I've never seen that photo before. So
wow.
I cannot wait to get down to Sarasota and sit Michelangelo down and be like, okay, let's go through all of this and just scan whatever we need in and just look through it all, because there's so much there still that are, you know, that has been lost, if you will, in family archives and crates and whatnot. So but it's just been quite an experience going through all of that. And yes, yeah, the connection with all those families and all those names, that's been really neat.
I know, we always are like, oh God, it's so hard to start a circus. How are all these other people doing it? And they're like, oh right, they've been around for like 20 years.
That feeling, but the like when Lindsay and I are just like, how do you make this work? And then I'm reading your parents or your book, your grandfather's book, and then your great grandfather's story of just like the various versions of the struggle throughout the many, many years, and when it's working really well and when it's not working so well.
Right.
And being like, man, this is a thing that people have been doing for decades, like, we'll
figure
it out.
That's the thing.
Like, it's
like,
always changing, you know.
The circus will survive, you know.
Yeah.
This is one thing that I feel and I hope is going to happen, is that there will be a resurgence of the circus. It's bad news for Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey. I never thought that I would see a complete fold-up of the show.
Yeah.
And I think it's the end of Ringling Brothers as we know it. It's my hope, and I sincerely do believe that it could come back again in a different way, in a different form. I just think it's going to be the end of this kind of touring show, this massive spectacle.
Mm-hmm. On a train.
There's the logistics of it, and there's the declining ticket sales and all this stuff, because as I even said in my introduction, there's all these challenges to live entertainment. You know, there's so many avenues for people to see.
Mm-hmm.
And now with the advent of, you know, the internet and all these other programs for people to watch, its focus is split.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just difficult sometimes just to get people out to live shows in general.
But there was another thing that you talked to me about and you highlighted in the, because I was reading on the Kindle and you highlighted, I think really applies to Big Apple today, but it's your grandfather's writing, but about how the circus, he like noticed that you shouldn't go back to the same place every year.
Yeah. Right.
And
that's
what we kept thinking about Big Apple, because I was like, I wonder if people are just like, I've seen it. I saw it last year, you know, and coming back to Lincoln Center every single year, I think is part of the problem that that is touched on in the book. Which I also you thought was an interesting tie-in too.
Yeah, I was just like all the how do you tour, when do you tour, where do you go, all those things are the same questions from 150 years ago as they are now, and those lessons still apply, even though sometimes you think maybe they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we are nearing our hour, so I do want to ask you the traditional ending questions.
Sure.
Although I feel like we'll probably end up doing part two of this at some point soon.
I know, I feel like we had to like, we like,
so much.
I was like, wait,
itself,
I want to get,
right?
I know,
well,
but also.
We didn't even really tackle like either of your childhood
specific
stories,
lives. I know, I was like, oh God, we're just like skipping. They're already in their 20s. Like, come on, wait.
Part two.
But the first question we like to ask is, has there been any piece of advice, good or bad, that you guys have received that has stuck with you?
Wow.
I know, right? Well, I think, and I don't remember who it was that said this to me, but just don't take anything for granted. Not, you know, not people, not your job, not your abilities, because everything can change in an instant. And, you know, just go out there and work hard for what you want, and don't feel that you're entitled to it. You know, that's one thing also is that you see sometimes is, you know, the arrogance and entitlement. So, well, what did you do to earn that? You know, why do you feel that you deserve that? Now, this is not to say, I mean, it's good to go with the flow and be flexible, right?
Right. I think it's kind of a sign of the times, right? With all the media of late, it's just the sense of entitlement that people feel. It's like, oh, you see something on TV, so that must be it, or that, you know, I can do that as well. And I think there still should be, you know, it's hard work.
Yeah, you have to dig a little bit deeper than just the surface, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
To really work hard at your craft, and don't be afraid to grow and look in other avenues. You know, as a circus performer, that's awesome. And, you know, working on the trick, the difficulties, and the technique of it all, but you also have to look at, you know, across platforms, because watching a great performer on stage doing the simplest thing can be so rewarding, and you can glean something from that as well. You know, it's really exciting when you see, you know, I've worked with, you know, thousands of performers, and they've been great and all that. But when you see somebody that's truly magical on stage, and all they have to do is just walk out on stage and give a look, you can see that presence. You can see that energy that they haven't really done anything, but stepped out on stage, but immediately you recognize something in that, you know? So it's like taking that with you wherever you go and then really working hard for it. That's not to say, you know, but back to the entitlement, not to fight for what you believe in, you know, for what you think you need, or to, whether it's for safety or, you know, other issues, but also being flexible at the same time, you know, really look at the space and really look at the overall picture of what you're doing and seeing how does it benefit you? But then, of course, how does it benefit the show, and how does it benefit everything else and the audience too? You know, I mean, you don't necessarily have to create everything for the audience specifically, but if you create it for the art, then either the audience is going to dig it or they're not. You know? But if it comes from a genuine place, more chances are that they will.
Yeah, stay calm. That's my thing.
Stay calm. Stay calm and carry a crossbow.
Did you have to have that? Stay calm and carry a crossbow. Elijah, stay calm. Yeah. Lindsay, carry a crossbow. A virtual reality game is this. Well, it's not a crossbow. It's a
bow and arrow.
Mm-hmm. But you like have to shoot these little like stick figure people that are storming your castle, and you have to like reload and everything. And I played it, and then the next day my arms hurt so bad. And I was like, this is fake. I can't even imagine. I'm just like holding a fake nothing, you know.
Right.
Like, boom.
Other than the Grand Gypsy, which I could not recommend more to people who listening and interested in circus, are there any other books or TV shows or movies that you would recommend to somebody who is a circus student right now and somebody who is, you know, wants to be part of this world? And
well, I would highly recommend going to see Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus before it folds.
I agree.
This is a piece of history, not just in the circus world, but this is a piece of Americana.
Yeah.
You know, this is 146
years,
right?
I know.
146 years.
Older than Coca-Cola, older than baseball.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I can't stress enough the importance of seeing that, you know, to experience what that is. Because like I said, I it is my hope that it's not the complete end of it. Yeah, sure, it might go away for a few years or whatnot, but it is my hope that there'll be a resurgence of it. Mm-hmm. But we just don't know in what form, and I don't think it'll be like this. Like I saw somebody post also in the Circus Historical Society, the trains.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the longest train that pulls the entire company. There's a few of them, actually. It's not just one train.
No, and
so
they have to keep up the whole private row. Yeah, it just must be so expensive.
Yeah.
The whole, because we were thinking, it's just like, if you add up all the costs, it just must be like
insane.
But that's what I was thinking. We were wondering, maybe they close it and just totally restructure how they do it.
Right. And that's my hope also for Big Apple Circus, obviously, you know, because it's in bankruptcy and whatnot. But there's
some rumors out there.
Exactly. You know, so there's a possibility it's not the end. I mean, the circus will survive.
Yeah.
You know, these are some devastating things that have, you know, happened in quick succession. You know, so
people always think the theater is going away. Like, what is theater is going to leave? Right. Like, Broadway's going to die. It's still there. And
it's still there. You know, there's, I mean, it doesn't take away the challenges. Obviously, they're there, and the financial hardships that you encounter and all those things that you have to take into account. But I mean, like the circus itself and the industry itself, it will survive. I mean, even during the Civil War, the circus was moving strong. You know, that's a difficult thing to do, especially because most circuses were from the North. So those ones that found themselves in the South had to improvise, you know, and it was interesting. But I have faith that the circus will survive. Yeah. Definitely.
Us too.
Yeah.
Clearly, or else we would be crying ourselves to sleep.
Well, kudos to you guys for doing that. You know, that's, I mean, seriously, that's great. It's a task, obviously, to take on, and but it's a rewarding thing, and it's something to really see. It's about the live experience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I find, you know, and that's the difficult thing. Yeah, there's tons of videos out there that you can watch, and you can send it home and watch YouTube video after YouTube
which
video
is also
and be inspired.
Very cool, but there's nothing. Like, you know, going to see a live show.
No.
That experience. Yeah.
Right. And just like the connection to, yeah. I mean, I maybe you feel this way too, since you kind of came into circus later in your life. I mean, I loved it when I was little, didn't remember that I loved it. Met Josh and, you know, was so focused on theater. And then he reintroduced me to the circus. And I was just like, oh my God. Because the connection that you find in theater is amazing, and I love going to a good play or musical that really makes you feel something. But it is really like there's the fourth wall, and there's you're sitting, and there's no talking, no nothing. You know, you're silent. But in the circus, you're like yoo-hoo, or like ah,
right.
And there's those like
you're encouraged to participate
in
the show,
and there's just nothing like it.
Yeah.
I think which made me fall in love with it.
Yeah, I mean. It's heartwarming too, you know, to see all these other companies too that are, you know, coming and like what you guys creating with Hideaway Circus, and then you have, you know, like Bindle Stiff, and then you have Lone Star Circus, mm-hmm. and then you have all these other companies that are, you know, working hard to make it happen. And like I said, there's faith in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to ask the last one?
Sure. Who do you guys suggest we have on our next podcast? Or not our next one, but at some point.
I think Dominique Jeandot. Is
a great
source of information. I mean, he's a wealth of information mm-hmm. there, and he is great.
Yeah,
definitely, he was somebody to have on.
He'd be awesome. He had his book right behind us.
Yes, yeah, that nice big one. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Thank you guys so much for coming to the podcast.
Yeah. I know.
Thanks for having us.
That was our interview with Otavio and Naomi Gizmundo.
If you like the interview and you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, rate us on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Thanks for listening, and next time we'll most likely be from Australia. So talk to you later, mate. That was really bad, Australia.
Have a good week.